Thank you very much for the kind invitation. I'm really glad to be here with you. So, as fast as I can, let me say first some things about the theoretical context. As you might know, there has been a very long period where emotions were virtually absent in political analysis. This is due to various reasons. I don't want to go into these reasons right now. And the last decade or so, a major affective turn or emotional turn has been happening in the entirety of social science and humanities, and this could not but affect political analysis as well. So, from a passionless political analysis, we are moving to an understanding of the politics emotions nexus, in the sense that you cannot have any sort of political behavior, any sort of political phenomenon without taking into consideration the affective side of it. Of course, not all political phenomena and sorts of political actions have the same affective weight, but emotion is already there, and there has been already there in all classical analysis, but the political analysts themselves hadn't realized it for so many decades. So far, it seems to me that two research directions have been emerged. I don't want to speak about research traditions. Maybe these two are traditions in the making, but let's speak about two different research traditions. One could be called political sociology of emotions theoretical tradition. There are works by Goodwin, by Berezin, Sefcik, others, many others, Kempers, etc. That is to say, a theoretical perspective with its appropriate methodological tools, which gives emphasis to macrostructural factors and relational factors, wherein emotions, different emotions, especially social emotions and moral emotions, are constructed, and in terms of methodology, they give emphasis to qualitative analysis, without, of course, ignoring quantitative analysis. They also give emphasis to in-depth interviews, psychoanalytic perspectives, and so on. The second direction, which is much more delineated and much more rigor in its theoretical framework and methodological tool, is the political psychology of emotions and political neuroscience. Just by passing, I should say that political sociology of emotions is not a coined expression. This is something which is used very, very rarely. Berezin and myself, I think, we have used this as a term for designating this approach. But political sociology of emotions is a very officially coined expression. And then herein, of course, one can find George Marcus and his colleagues, and Leonie Hardy, and many other. Competent American scholars, David Lodge among them, who put emphasis on the micro level, and they give emphasis as well to the way individuals proceed political information and the styles of information they are seeking while acting politically, or while they are exposed in political messages through political communication. A great and very aching problem is how one defines emotion. This is the most difficult problem in emotional studies whatsoever. So, as a working definition, I'm offering this this preliminary, at least, conception that emotion is the conscious or unconscious arousal of the human organism which induces a readiness for action and evaluations of objects, relations and situations within a definite time context. The thing is that in our de-differentiating era, where not only disciplines and sub-disciplines in humanities and the social sciences converge, but also different sciences are converging, it would be useless, I think, to leave to these two directions developing past each other. So, to my mind, it's of crucial importance just to avoid mistakes and misunderstandings which have been made in other disciplines in previous decades. So, it might be crucial now nowadays where we are in the beginning of the development of these two approaches, just to build bridges. And there will be a number of advantages by building bridging the divide between these directions. I just mentioned three of them. First of all, one would be the taxonomic criteria proper to the emotions politics nexus. I can tell you that there is a host of a number of taxonomic criteria in the psychology of emotions, in the sociology of emotions, and the political neuroscience of emotions. Perhaps by converging the two directions, we might find a better taxonomic criteria. Then, building bridges, I mean, we may triangulate methodological approaches, and also we may be able to translate the emotional terms of each other direction or perspective. So let me now come into the main corpus of my presentation, which has to do with the crisis in Greece. If you take a look at various headlines, news items, etc. in television, they are full of emotional terms, negative emotional terms, either in a denotative or a connotative fashion. One may find emotional terms in describing anger, anxiety, worth, rage, fear, threat, distrust, disgust, and so on and so forth. But one should take into account that this negative mood is not unique in Greece, it's not the first time that we have such a negative emotional climate. For more than two decades, in all international comparative measures, we find that Greece is down to the bottom as far as the democracy is concerned, as far as political alienation, political cynicism is concerned, as far as social capital is concerned, and so on and so forth. So the main question right now, and so far, is that despite the unprecedented cruelty of the crisis, there has been a striking absence of mass public protest and demonstrations or organized contentious politics. And I want here to stress organized and mass scale. Of course, we know and we see that there is a number of incidents and of occurrences of violent occurrences and so on, but this do not constitute organized contentious politics. And given the cruelty of the crisis, the question is why? Why is that so? So let me give a number of interpretations based on the political sociology of emotion perspective and on the political psychology perspective. First, on the political psychology perspective. Political sociology of emotions perspective. The first has to do with the crisis of trauma. It is not accidental that even the Prime Minister spoke about crisis limited national sovereignty because of the crisis. And it is not accidental that some commentators in Greek, in respectful Greek newspaper, they speak about our national trauma or social trauma and so on and so forth. So, drawing mainly from Freud, I would say that a severe economic depression, as the current crisis in Greece may experience and theoretically understood as trauma as long as it causes a breakdown in daily routines and expose at the same time the largely taken for granted values which guide them. That is to say, trauma is something which disrupts the social fabric. Okay, but not only that. People cannot accept it in the first place. People using a defense mechanism confront trauma by expressions like it cannot happen to us. I don't believe it is happening. It is impossible to have it happen here. And so on and so forth. It's exactly the same responses when, for instance, Olaf Palme was assassinated in the center of Stockholm, or immediately after JF Kennedy's assassination in Dallas. So it seems to me that this partly explains why Greeks do not respond to the crisis in an organized, contentious manner. Precisely because crisis experienced as trauma for many Greeks, not for all of them of course, has not so far accommodated within their own symbolic universe. Of course, whoever speaks about trauma has to pose the question, trauma for whom? As I said, not everybody experiences the crisis as trauma, or not everybody experiences the crisis as trauma in an equal way. But this is a long story, I don't want to go into that story. The second tenet is the social trust deficit. Greek society is a society quite fragmented, a society which has a notorious lack of a potent civil society, is a society with a very weak bridging social capital, not bonded social capital, bridging social capital, and of course in a period of crisis, a society which is characterized by low social trust and low social capital cannot develop solidarity, and you cannot have mass contentious politics, mass movement politics against the crisis without solidarity. Another thing is the ambivalence towards injustice. When a couple of months ago, our notorious government in Vice President Theodore Pangalos declared that we all ate the money. I don't know if it's the exact expression in English.
Together we
ate the money. Okay, we spent the money. We whatever. Referring to the state deficit and the external debt, an angry wave of protestation was raised by the media and the public opinion against this blatant statement. But as cynical as this statement might be, in itself, there has been, it seems to me, an overreaction in its forceful denunciation. It was as if Greeks wanted to diminish their own share of responsibility compared to that of the power elite. Yet, despite differences in social hierarchy and differential distribution of socioeconomic power, they know deep inside that they are somewhat unavoidably guilty for the devastated plight of the country. And then I'm going to the fourth tenet, and I will connect it to the third. Hopelessness and inefficacy. We know very well for instance from Barrington Moore, the notorious book Injustice, the Social Basis of Revolt and Obedience, that you cannot have mass protest action or a revolution or a riot or whatever or contentious politics as I said at a mass organized scale without being based, without triggered by a sense of moral outrage. And this moral outrage is caused by a broken sense of justice. And this is actually the case in Greece. Most Greeks experience a sense of injustice, but they experience it in a peculiar way. And this peculiar way can be named by a double-edged blocked feeling of social injustice. As I mentioned above at the third tenet, they are aware that they are more or less responsible for the crisis, but at the same time they are not willing to pay the price. As grievances are more easily addressed to the powerful than to ourselves, the logic of this double-edged feeling goes as following. Although I know that it is my fault as well, I am unjustifiably punished. This is an antithetical mixture of moral self-consciousness on the one hand, of course, and a displacement of guilt and responsibility on the other. And undertaking the risk of oversimplification, I would claim that for many Greeks right now, and I stress this right now, I don't know what's going to happen in 6 months or 1 year from now, this special sort of double thinking is a defense mechanism activated by the traumatic experience of the crisis. Very briefly, you cannot have you cannot have any sort of political protestation unless you have two other emotions apart from moral outrage: efficacy and hope. I don't have time to go deep into that, but as you see in this scheme, whenever you have, in the cases you have strong efficacy and strong hope, you might have contentious politics, protest movement, etc. Whenever you have strong efficacy and less hope, you have acting out and anomic disaffection, which is actually the case in Greece right now. all these protestations, all these grievances and all these occurrences, violent occurrences, for, to my mind, are plebeian in character, populist in character, and it is forms of collective acting out, in a way. And as you see, there are cases where you have less efficacy, with hope, with much hope, which leads to passive bystanders, like action. And whenever you have less efficacy and less hope, you have helplessness, despair, isolation. And what it seems to be happening today in Greece is that we have chondromes 3 and 4 corresponds to what actually goes on in Greece right now. Obviously, I don't have time to get into many details and explain what's going on, how the political psychology of emotion would help us, but just a few comments on anger and anxiety. Anger and anxiety are two separate emotions where political psychologists of emotion, political neuroscience give great emphasis on. And from their experimental measurements, they have concluded that anger is targeted to individual rather than to institutions. Anger promotes heuristic information processing and greater reliance on stereotypes, that is to say, it perpetuates partisanship outlooks. Anger is risk-taking, that is to say, it may lead more easily to action rather than inaction. And also there is an effect of diffusion effect of anger, which is likely to lead to scapegoating. I just remind you that nowadays in Greece we have a great wave against the immigrants, which is a typical case for deviating anger towards specific groups or individuals. Whereas anxiety is targeted to institutions rather than individuals, is linked to systematic information processing, that is to say, anxious people or fearful people are seeking to new information and they are trying to understand what's going on. And that's why maybe they are anxious individuals are risk averted. Yes, that is to say, anxiety more or less leads to inaction. So, this being said, I'm going to end my presentation with two working hypotheses, which has to be worked out by myself or by my students. Which is, first, elite, and when I say elite, I mean media, politicians, and public opinion makers, would systematically promote anxious and messages that trigger anger. Why is that so? Because, as I said before, anxiety and fear leads to inaction rather than action. So you don't. As soon as they will promote such kind of messages and such kind of propaganda, they will steer clear from mass protest politics or contentious politics. Working hypothesis two: elite would oscillate between systematically promote anxious and angry messages, to the extent that anger is linked to personalized blaming and anxiety is action constraining. Since anger, as I said, is either directed towards specific individuals, they may deviate blaming to specific scapegoatings, scapegoat, scapegoat, uh, scapegoated groups or individuals, not to the institutions, not to capitalism itself. Peculiar. I haven't used this word for quite two decades. Capitalism. Although I used to be a Hegelian Marxist 30 years ago. And on the other hand, anxiety, as I said, is action constraining. So they have to oscillate in order to protect the partisanship landslide, and in order to at least to stabilize the situation, the elites are bound to oscillate between these two kinds of propaganda and public policy. So that was all for the moment, and I will frankly comment on your questions. Thank you very much.